Hello, we are sponsored today by Effin' Birds. It's actually our title sponsor, so we are technically the Effin' Birds Travolta Cage Podcast. Effin' Birds are, of course, the Dirty Birds people. They have the delightfully viral, very, very popular Twitter feed, Effin' Birds, and in case you don't know what that means, fucking, because they are some dirty motherfuckers, but they're also, you know, delightful motherfuckers and precious motherfuckers, and we would like to thank them, and we're very, very proud that we are now the Effin' Birds Travolta Cage Podcast. We're coming up in the world, and if that's not exciting enough, we have a second sponsor. It is the Greg Olson Experience, traveling again, the legacy continues. It's an experimental... Oh, one second. Here is that one. Hello, Tuneheads! Have you ever looked for new music? Did you ever want to add something new to your library? I am calling for you! Do you hear a festival? A Scandinavian festival? Can you detect the Moscow Boogie? Have you done business with a Portuguese company? You have a choice to hear the truth. Welcome to the experience. The Greg Olson Experience, traveling again. The legacy continues. Out now on Bandcamp at tgosounds.bandcamp.com. Tuneheads. And that's tgosounds.bandcamp.com.
Oh, it's a period and a dot. Wow, this is complicated. Welcome to the latest episode of Travolta Cage, a podcast about the two most fascinating actors in movie history. I'm one of your hosts, Clint Worthington, senior writer for Consequence of Sound and editor-in-chief of The Spool.
And my name is Nathan Rabin, and I am the proprietor and the primary writer and sole writer, other than Clint, of course, for Nathan Rabin's Happy Cast. Now, what the fuck am I talking about? Nathan Rabin's Happy Place. HappyCast was our old.
Is dead.
Yes. HappyCast is.
HappyCast isn't dead. It's surely alive. And we have with us a very special guest, one returning from the old show, Dan McCoy of the Flophouse. Hello, Dan.
Hello. I apologize if you ever hear any clanking on my end. I have a drink that I have a reusable metal straw with because I'm a very responsible person.
So sustainable. Yes. I mean, I was just presuming because you have a series of gears and servos inside you, and that's what we'd be hearing, the clanking and whirring and buzzing, I presume.
I am also a robot.
Yes, a robot. In case you don't know what this podcast is, first of all, thank you for listening. And second of all, it's a podcast where the two of us, Nathan and I, along with selected guests, go through the filmographies of John Travolta and Nicolas Cage, two actors who, as you know, co-starred in the cinema masterpiece that is Face Off, but have also paralleled in intriguing ways throughout their decades of film experience for both good and ill. And this is a podcast exploring that. And this week, we actually have the rare treat of, and I don't mean to presume to speak for the both of you, for talking about two good movies this time around.
Yeah, I would go so far to say that one is good and one is great.
Yes, yes. We're talking, of course, about Brian De Palma's Blowout, starring John Travolta, and Francis Ford Coppola's Peggy Sue Got Married, once again, starring his nephew, Nicolas Cage, and also Kathleen Turner, but mostly Nicolas Cage. And Nicolas Cage's false teeth and Pokey from Gumby voice. So yeah, so we're very excited to talk about those. But before we do, we want to remind you once again that we have a Patreon, patreon.com/TravoltaCage. Please pledge to it. It helps us keep the lights on. We can't just lean on F and Birds. As much love to F and Birds, but they you know, their largesse only goes so far.
Well, I would also like to say that our sponsor is For the Birds in the best possible way.
Indeed. And I am in no way against the birds, too. So that also helps. So, yeah, please go to patreon.com/TravoltaCage and pledge to us. Now, without further ado, let's just start talking about these movies. I really want to talk about Blowout first.
He's the one who saw it?
Yes, he says he pulled a girl out of the car.
And I would like you to forget about her.
Yeah, that's what I heard just before the tire blew out. You're right, it was a shot.
He recorded a murder. They say it never happened.
There are still loose ends, witnesses. The girl, I've decided to terminate her. Terminate her. Terminate her.
Brian De Palma's Blowout. Now you hear it. Now you don't.
Nathan, why don't you talk to me about what Blowout is about?
Sure. This was Brian De Palma's 1981 thriller. It was kind of his take on Blowout.
Blow up.
Blow up? Yes. This one is Blow Up. Wait. Yeah, Blow Up, and this one is...
Yes. Antonioni is Blow Up. And De Palma is Blowout.
Yeah, definitely. So this was sort of his take on that. This was a very rare Brian De Palma to be taking inspiration from other filmmakers. That seemed weird, you know? He's usually so daringly original. This was a 1981 thriller that he filmed. It was a big old box office flop. And in it, John Travolta takes a break from playing sexy idiots, who are also sexy assholes, to play a very, very smart, very accomplished sound man. And he makes a living curating sounds and finding sounds. And it's a testament to what an amazing actor and how charismatic John Travolta is that he can literally just be listening, you know, you can just be standing there hearing sounds, and it's abso-fucking-lutely riveting. And then he is out looking for sounds one evening, and he overhears a murder, and the police don't think it's a murder, and it's very kind of Chappaquiddicky. There's a presidential nominee, and he dies in a fatal car crash, and John Travolta's character, he happens upon it and he saves a woman played by Nancy Allen, who was Brian De Palma's wife at the time. And
Travolta's co-star in Carrie, right?
Yeah. So she always gets to play a sex worker or some sort of evil bitch.
Or RoboCop's partner.
Yeah.
That's not in a De Palma movie.
Maybe. I'm saying in De Palma's movies, he always seems like the Asia Argento thing going on, where he's like, I can only see you as some sort of sex worker, or some sort of horrible monster.
Woman I love.
Yeah, and she's really, really great in this, and very, very vulnerable as well. And so he's very obsessive, and he's very meticulous, and nobody really wants to solve this. Everybody wants to just sort of sweep it under the rug. Everybody has, you know, things to benefit from just forgetting that this ever happened. And he figures out that the person behind this, that this was not a regular car crash, that the tire was blown out by a shotgun, with a shotgun blast. And the person who did the shooting was John Lithgow. And this was one of his really kind of like his first really big performances. And I think I can say without hyperbole, this is maybe one of the greatest villains of all time. Like, I thought he was just so fucking fascinating. And it's funny, I was thinking kind of like, oh, like him being in this movie, it's like you dropped Norman Bates into an Alfred Hitchcock movie.
Yeah, there is such a psychosexual element of that performance.
Norman Bates, we took that psychotic, fascinating, really in-depth character and dropped him into like a really kind of a perfect thriller. Like watching this again, I was kind of the mindset like this could not be any better. And it's also, you know, kind of a masterclass.
Wait, are you saying that if you took Norman Bates and dropped him into a perfect thriller? As opposed to the shit show that's Psycho.
Yeah.
I think of that as like a shocker, you know?
Okay, I gotcha.
This also has a
more of a chiller.
It's not like Harley Quinn in Suicide Squad. It's like this character has potential, but I wish the movie was better.
And I guess also I feel like this is, you know, from 1981, but it's very much a 1970s movie, in part because it's incredibly cynical about politics. It just kind of assumes that audiences will assume that everybody in politics are corrupt. And
it's a very post-Watergate movie.
And getting away with it. It's very post-Chappaquiddick as well. And there's this, yeah. I mean, it makes amazing, amazing use of Philadelphia locations. It also makes really, really fascinating, dark, ironic use of patriotism and the Liberty Bell. And there is all this, you know, sort of patriotic fodder all. And then the reality of the situation is evil triumphs, you know, and people who want the truth are sad, lonely, solitary creatures kind of fighting against this huge evil establishment.
Okay, cool. Dan, what is your experience with Blowout?
Well, you know, I mean, so there was a book that my local library had growing up that was, you know, downstairs in the children's section that was called something like Great American Directors. And I have no idea why I was drawn to this.
No, you misread it. It was actually Great American Directors.
Oh, wow. It's weird.
Very snide.
It's weird that everything inside it was so glowing then. But
yeah, like Frank Capra is such a genius. All his movies are so good. Preston Sturges, you've done it again.
All books are better when read sarcastically.
You became a bitterly sarcastic cinephile.
Yeah. But as a child, like, I don't know what drew me to this. Like, I also picked up an old Roger Ebert's movie yearbook with the cover torn off at a library sale for like a quarter when I was a kid. And both of these books were things I just read over and over again. And the writer, I mean, these are not necessarily like your John Fords or your Howard Hawkses or whatever. Like, this is definitely 70s, early 80s idea of great American directors. You know, Robert Altman, Hal Ashby, Spielberg, and they had De Palma in there. Sorry?
Losers.
Yeah, losers all. I think that kind of... So I read this book that I guess was ostensibly for young adults, but I don't know then why it was talking so much about, you know, like people like Altman or Brian De Palma. But, it, you know, I wanted to see De Palma movies because... I, too, as Brian De Palma does, loved Hitchcock. And I think the first De Palma movie I saw probably was on A&E some afternoon, like in a slightly edited for content version of Sisters, which is one of his most Hitchcockian. But, you know, like a lot of De Palma's movies I couldn't see as a young man as they're steeped in sleaze. Although I do remember, like... watching the beginning of Carrie when I should have been asleep, like sneaking out to watch it and seeing the slow motion pan through a nudity filled locker room and being like, okay, well, this is the best thing in the world. Because, like, I mean, he is one of the many things he took from Hitchcock was the pervy male gaze.
I was going to say, they're both masters of tightly coiled thrillers and also huge pervazoids.
Yeah, I mean, like, there's. I watched this with my girlfriend who doesn't really know who De Palma is. I mean, like, she has seen Carrie, for instance, but would not have, like, an association with who directed that. And she enjoyed it very much, but she's like, okay, well, what makes a De Palma movie a De Palma movie? I'm like, well, you know, he's highly stylized. He likes his split screens. He likes his split diopters. You know, he loves putting together suspense set pieces. He's much more kind of interested in like pure movie making most of the time than like deep emotion. And that's kind of why movie people, I think, like him a lot, because he is like sheer craft. And then also he has this like perviness that's almost endearing because it is so close to the surface. He does not try and hide it. Like in that, I feel this weird like kinship with, say, like Paul Verhoeven, where it's like, okay,
yeah,
there's this perversity that just kind of like pervades the movie. And if you enjoy it, you enjoy it. If you don't, I kind of understand why. Maybe you wouldn't, but like it's there.
It's an acquired taste.
Yeah.
That seems like a good place to talk about the opening of this film. And Dan, right or not, you have a bit of a reputation as a pervozoid. So I was totally thinking about you during this opening sequence. And again, I think in my piece I talk about it being kind of like a Russian nesting doll of perversion, of voyeurism. And there's one shot, it's kind of a riff on Carrie, it's kind of a riff on Halloween, and the idea of the subjective filming. And we, the perverted audience, are sharing the perspective of this deranged sorority girl slasher. And then at one point we're looking at the slasher, looking at a cop, staring at these gorgeous women in very little clothing. It feels like self-parody, brilliant self-parody. And it also sets up the movie. And that sort of the catalyst for it is we end, and again, it's an elaborate fake out. It's a very easy fake out because
it's a very long form comedic gag too.
Definitely. So there's just like the craft is absolutely gorgeous. And finally, there's a scream, and it's a terrible scream, and it completely violates the reality of everything. And then you could look at this movie as the search for a meaningful and convincing scream. And in that way, I was thinking, this could kind of be a very long episode of Tales from the Crypt.
Which, by the way, speaking of which, he he mentions the many like trashy movies he's worked on, and one of the titles he tosses off is Bordello of Blood, which of course there later on was a Tales from the Crypt : Bordello of Blood, starring Dennis Miller. Yeah.
Which, if you do have blood in your colon, please see a doctor. Yes. And you mentioned, Dan, earlier, like, one of De Palma's signposts is that he's very obsessed with craft and sort of, like, there is this almost metatextual films about filmmaking sort of deal to a lot of his stuff. And Blowout is no exception because the main character is a sound guy. The inciting incident is him trying to find new sound effects for this movie, and he uses the power of sound editing to solve mysteries, which I think is very appealing.
Well, and it's like such a fascinating time capsule because, I was into the idea of being a filmmaker as a kid. Like, that's what I aspired to for years and years and years, to the point that I went to film school briefly after college and, dropped out, realizing that, like, the technical aspects of it, other than editing, which I was pretty good at, I had no interest in. Even at that time, like, the stuff that, I'm 41. The stuff that he's doing here in this movie was like had already been on the way out, for a good while by the time I started trying to make movies at that period, And so it's this interesting look at process too, to see how movies were made back then, to see like the actual use of tape and editing tape and matching it up with the visuals.
Yeah, like those long pans and close-ups of just like reels moving. It feels like just as exhibitionist, just as voyeuristic and sort of pornographic almost as the shots of the naked women in the beginning,
One of the things we've kind of discovered over the course of doing this podcast is all these weird kind of rhymes and themes and patterns. And I was thinking, I've seen this movie before, and it was brilliant before, and it was made about 8 years earlier by Nicolas Cage's uncle. A movie called The Conversation. Which very much, again, is kind of, you're sort of talking about pure cinema, sort of in movies for pure cinephiles. And movies that on a very fundamental level are about the filmmaking process and about it as sort of as a craft, as an obsession, as a way to kind of understand the world.
Right. And so with Blowout, sort of what you get is that, you know, pursuit of kind of the perfect set of filmmaking that opens up into this more, into this political thriller that sort of stops being political after a while. One thing I noted was that how quickly people gave up on the political angle. Like, it just sort of become just this chase. I mean, just that, like, you know, the political conspiracy stuff, I think, gets solved pretty quickly. And not that it's not important, but it becomes much more about the mechanics of the chase, especially in that final act. Like, John Travolta is not out to expose a conspiracy necessarily, like, any, like, by the end. He's just there saving Nancy Allen. I just find that stuff kind of really interesting. And Nancy Allen, especially, like, doing a whole lot with what is kind of just like a Brian De Palma bimbo.
Well, she's a damsel in distress, you know? She needs to be sad. And I was thinking, like, you know, basically John Travolta is the only good person in this movie. Yeah. He's the only person who has, like, pure motivations. And Nancy Allen, like, she's... Again, there's something very winning and very kind of touching about her vulnerability.
Well, he has pure motivations, but, like, I do think that... You know, there's a good point with the kind of discarding the political things. I mean, on the one hand, you've got John Lithgow, who, like, has clearly gone off the reservation, like, from the start, and is just kind of a psychotic killer who is an assassin because it gives him an excuse to kill people. But John Travolta's interest in this largely, I mean, other than self-preservation, which becomes a concern later on, early it seems to be he just doesn't want people to get one over on him. Like, he seems kind of insulted by the idea that these people are trying to trick everyone. I mean, like, and...
Well, they also reveal he has that history as, like, an informant, or, like, he used to be a cop, you know, and then so he's haunted by this deal gone bad, so he doesn't want that to happen again.
Mm-hmm. Really interesting. I was looking this up on Wikipedia, and you're not to be surprised that Al Pacino at one point was thought for the lead in this movie. And yeah, it would have been good, kind of a little bit more typecasty. I think it was interesting to see John Travolta play this role. But that scene, and it's really, really compelling, where sort of there's a flashback and John Travolta reveals how, you know, sort of his time as a sound guy for the police came to a very, very dramatic and violent end. Was originally from Brian De Palma, was going to do Prince of the City, the Sidney Lumet movie with Tree Williams that I have not seen, but has very, very good reviews. And that was like a remnant of when he was working on that. And it is a really, really great sequence. And again, I just feel like so much of this movie is about craft. Like, on the big things, he gets everything right. And then there are, like, small things. Like, that's the coolest shot of a owl I've ever seen.
It's so good.
You know, there's just, like, this deep composition. There's, like, this split screen. There's just, like, this dazzling mastery of craft that has its own pleasures beyond the theme.
That composite shot when he figures out the tire was shot out. When he's in one corner of the frame and that, like, straight on shot of the spinning tire is right there is, like, beautiful collage art, you know?
I want to jump back to a second. It's interesting to me that backstory comes from a different movie, because I will say that, like, I mean, it does sort of explain why he's the world's most competent sound guy when it comes to solving mysteries. But at the same time, it does kind of feel like it's from somewhere else, in the sense that it's the sort of thing that often annoys me in movies, where it's like, you don't need to necessarily give me a backstory that tells me why someone cares about, like, not getting killed or, you know, unraveling a conspiracy. Yeah,
right. Like, or it's like in survival horror movies where they reveal later that, like, the main character or whatever has, like, special ops experience or something like that.
Exactly.
Like, it's, yeah, I get that.
But this movie gets away with it, I think, because it does it so well. Like, just, like, by this craft of that flashback.
Yeah, like, there's a shaggy dog element to a lot of De Palma's stuff, and the fact that it holds together so well is a testament to that, to his skill.
And this is also a movie where, like, they just get the details really, really right. Like, there are so many wonderful supporting performances. One of my favorite is Dennis Franz.
with as you said, the filthiest undershirt in movie history.
He won the Academy Award for filthiest undershirt in 1981. And he just brings so much and again, it's kind of that's how he knows Nancy Allen, is they kind of have a con, you know, where she will, you know, be in compromising positions with powerful, wealthy men, and they'll take pictures and then they will blackmail people for it. And it's such a scuzzy character. It could just be like an extra. But like Dennis Franz, because he's such a compelling character actor, he brings so much to the role. Like even like his Chicago accent. Like it's so pronounced and he's such a Chicago guy. And you know, this is such a Philly movie. Like, he does many things right, and one of which is to have a really wonderful sense of place and a wonderful sense of time.
Yeah, like, you can kind of hear the Italian beef juices sort of dripping out of his mouth, just like with the Chicago accent. No, I love the scene with him and Nancy Allen where, like, he lets slip that he was going to get paid more for the job than he told her. And it's this beautiful sort of tete-a-tete where he keeps trying to sort of, like, excuse away the three, yeah, it's three now, three after, that kind of stuff. It's just beautiful little touches like that.
Well, and I like how Nancy Allen plays it, too, because, like, you know, she is slow on the uptake at many points during the movie.
But I think at times she's smarter than she lets on.
Yeah, there she's like, you know, she's perfectly sad when he's like, no, you know, I was going to give you the money after I got it. And she's like, yeah, sure. Like, you know, she's a little sad kind of look down. And like, in general, I think that she's terrific in this movie because, I don't know, in a lesser movie, this character would be borderline offensive because she is she is pretty dim. And the thing is, like, there it's not like there aren't people out there who are pretty dim in the world of both sexes, of men and women, but too often that sort of the dizzy dame is the stereotype. But this movie just gets away with it because she has such sweetness and humanity that you just like her so much.
Well, I mean, the fact that like her big goal in life, like her big ambition is to be a makeup person on Hollywood movies, like that's really poignant. And that's also very specific.
Mm-hmm.
And again, that kind of, you know, says a lot about who she is and definitely sort of feeds into the sense of this is a movie about filmmaking on the surface, on a bunch of different levels. Like this is so invested in that world. And she really does have nice chemistry with John Travolta, who relatively rarely for a Brian De Palma movie, like, is not a horny motherfucker who's not out to get laid.
That struck me during the movie. Like, the one kind of like iffy thing he does is like press her for coffee by saying like, hey, I saved your life, I deserve some coffee. But like, he's clearly more interested in unraveling the mystery. He's not doing this for sleazy reasons. And he like also backs off immediately. You know, he doesn't press necessarily.
No, of course. I think we should talk about Travolta then. I mean, obviously, since this is the subject of the podcast, this is a great role for him, especially in comparison to the roles we've had before, because he's come off the back of all of these starring roles where he is, for lack of a better term, like, his character is kind of the showcase. Like, it is a character study of this guy, whether it's Saturday Night Fever or Urban Cowboy or God help me moment by moment. But this is where he is. He's a mechanism, really. Like, he is an observer to the plot. He is an investigator. It's not necessarily about him as a character. He is just the protagonist of this genre flick. And in so doing, like, I think it pulls back a lot of the showier the showier tics he tends to have even this early in his career. And he gets to just sort of be a cog in the machine, so to speak. And I think he functions really well there.
Yeah. I was thinking that, like, he goes big so often that it's interesting to see him just be, like, a normal guy.
Yeah.
Like,
I love watching him react.
A normal guy. Like, yeah.
Oh, it seems to me like this is also maybe the first time he's ever played a character where him being ridiculously attractive isn't really a matter, isn't a factor.
Yeah.
You know, that the fact that he's like, that he looks like a movie star, like, it doesn't really matter. You know, he kind of looks exhausted. He looks worn out. He always looks like he needs some sleep in this movie. It's, again, it's the rare thing where he makes his living through his mind and with his hands, as opposed to being a ridiculously good-looking dude. It's also one of, you know, sort of like with Peggy Sue Got Married, he's a grown-up. You know, he played a teenager, he played a young dude for so much of his early careers, but by this point, he's very, I mean, freaking Grease was 3 years earlier, you know, and he's playing a 17-year-old, but he is very thoroughly a grown-up, and he totally commands it, and he's not a terribly cerebral actor, you know, but there's something about the obsessiveness, and it's kind of like with Tom Cruise, where Tom Cruise also not a terribly cerebral actor, but the will and the intelligence needed to become that level of a superstar, like, I think allows him, both of those actors, to play characters like, in Primary Colors, people who have a lot going on, and people who are smart and incisive and savvy in ways that, yeah, a lot of the characters he's played up until this point are not.
And he plays tragedy and terror really well here. I mean, both in the flashback and at the very end, I love how he underplays how, like, coming across these dead bodies of people he cares about. And I just love scanning his face for that, like, thought process. It's really cool.
I do think it's interesting, too, like, for a guy who I think kind of his, like, most iconic role, like, if you think of the Travolta persona, if such a thing exists, like, I feel like a lot of his iconic roles are people who are maybe not so smart. And so you forget that, like, you know, he can totally play a very, very smart guy. Like, this guy, like, other than...
as opposed to Phenomenon, where he plays the smartest man in the world.
That's true. But, like, the plot mechanisms in this movie sort of make him act a little dumb toward the end to set up the ironic ending. But otherwise, he is, like, on point the whole time and totally believable as that.
I feel like we haven't talked a lot about John Lithgow and how amazing he is in this. One thing that's interesting to me is that it seems like he has a very ambivalent, ambiguous backstory. I felt like he's kind of, to me, it seemed like he was a bit of a Lee Harvey Oswald type figure, where it seemed like he probably had some, like, really heavy government military experience, and that went weird. It looks like it might be Black Ops. Like, what do you think is this dude's background? Other than killing a lot of people and being very happy and excited about doing so. And being very being as good at killing as John Travolta is at solving crimes using audio.
Right. Yeah, I think I like how much of an enigma he is. I don't even know if I want to know much more about this guy, just because I think De Palma tells you everything you need to know, where he is obviously this very cruel, psychopathic, very skilled operator. But something about this case or something else has activated something very dark and psychosexual within him that causes him to sort of go off the rails, so to speak.
Yeah.
And he just becomes this, like, he's even like, you know, all of his performances over the payphones too is very interesting and calculating.
I think it's funny to me that, like, he is, you know, clearly, like, the most competent person in the movie while still, like, simultaneously somehow being sort of a bumbler in the fact, just in that, like, you know, he's on the phone with whoever is behind the conspiracy, and the other person's like, no, I don't want you to do any of this. Stop it. What are you doing? He's like, check, gotcha, you know.
He's not a good communicator, let's
no,
say.
No, no. I mean, well, he has his own agenda, and that agenda is murdering people.
Yeah, it's pretty wild. But no, it's a great performance, and I think it's a great, like you said, you know, it's a good early evil John Lithgow performance, which preludes such wonderful turns as Cliffhanger and the fourth season of Dexter.
And Ricochet, don't forget Ricochet.
Yes.
And Raising Kane for Brian De Palma.
That's right, yeah.
There's a very smart man who's good at getting things done and looked at John Lithgow and said, there's an evil motherfucker who just wants to kill people.
And also Roger Ailes now. So add that to the list.
I was watching Conan, and it literally seemed like he had hundreds of pounds of fat suits in order to play Roger Ailes.
Yeah, pretty much.
Slightly less creepy than the person that he plays in Blowout.
I like to think that at some point his Winston Churchill fat suit got slipped in there somewhere with Roger Ailes, and he just, like, didn't know he was wearing it one day.
Yeah.
Or he planned to, like, sneak one in and see if anyone noticed. But anyway, back to Blowout. I think we should probably talk about just that amazing climax, that beautifully extended chase sequence where it's a great De Palma suspense set piece where, like, you're watching, you know that Nancy Allen's in John Lithgow's sort of possession, so to speak, and she's going to run off to get killed, and John Travolta can hear everything that's going on and is trying desperately to catch up. It's such a cool, cool sequence.
Yeah, I mean, I would argue that the thing for me when watching it was that the train stuff is so great, and Travolta listening in and not knowing where she's talking from and wanting her to give him a clue about where she's talking about. And then once he gets to the celebration, it's great. But then, like, I do think that the chase scene, such as it is...
Like the car chase?
The car chase is pretty goofy. And maybe De Palma at that point in his career was better at thriller mechanics than pure action. Like, he got better at it with, like, say, Mission Impossible.
I think the rear projection doesn't help.
Yeah.
I think the rear projection doesn't help because you're just like watching Travolta just like spinning a wheel, the steering wheel madly while just like it looks like it's mad right. world a little bit.
And it's also kind of funny that the whole chase ends with him just hitting a building and like falling and like passing out for several hours apparently.
Liberty or death. And yet in those several hours, like John Lithgow still hasn't managed to kill Nancy Allen. How long does it take to traverse Philly, I ask you?
Like, you sort of talked about being a bit of a bumbler and also a psychotic at the same point. Like, yeah, there's that great scene where he spends 4 fucking minutes painstakingly chasing and then pursuing and then brutally murdering somebody who has a perm but is not Nancy Allen, you know? Yeah, I just kind of feel like he's into the whole hired killer gang because, like, he gets to kill so many bonus people. That's where all of the joy is. He'd do it for, I think about, like, Mikey and Nikki, where Ned Beatty's character is a hired assassin, but the great thing about him is that he only cares about, like, making money. So he's, like, yeah, the most pragmatic person in the world, where, yeah, John Lithgow is in it for the killing and the money and the prestige and the, you know, that's nice, but really he just wants to murder people.
Yeah, yeah, like you can tell, like he kind of gets his rocks off, like murdering women who kind of look like Nancy Allen. So, there is definitely that. But it also, you know, it results in that beautiful, very De Palma sort of like slow motion running through the fireworks. You know, with completely sound, you know, sound off with that overwrought in the best way kind of score just booming over John Travolta. And I don't know, it's the last few minutes of Blowout, I think, are just amazing, especially that beautiful button at the end where it all comes back to the scream.
Well, I when it, like, I mean, I love the very fake but deliberately so sort of you know, shot of him holding her with the fireworks going off and those over dramatic De Palma strings. And I actually like the score is interesting because it vacillates between being terrific and then having like the craziest 80s electric guitar riffs. And I looked up the guy who did it, and he's, you know, De Palma's regular composer, did a ton of stuff, but you alluded to me earlier being a pervazoid, Nathan. And he did a bunch of Tinto Brass scores, too, including one for Cheeky, the ode to Naked Ladies Behind. So,
yay.
There you go.
Well, we should also probably point out that the cinematographer for this was Vilmos Vigmund, who, again, one of the greatest cinematographers of all time. You know, he's done a lot of stuff with Spielberg. You know, he's done a lot of stuff with, Deer Hunter, Rose, Heaven's Gate, well, which is an Easter egg of the Bonfire of the Vanities. So, yeah, he's one of the greatest cinematographers of all time, and he has really great chemistry with De Palma. And then he's a big part of the reason why this movie is so masterful. I think Richard Silbert or Paul Silbert, the production designer, also a legend, did fantastic work here. So, yeah, you had the most talented people in the world working on this. And yeah, this is definitely like top 5 De Palma for me. It's like,
definitely.
Paradise. Yeah. Like, it's like there's nothing that I would find fault in. It's pretty much a perfect movie.
No, I totally agree. This is, you know, anyone who's been to my place, you included Nathan, know how large my Criterion wall is. And this was actually one of the first Criterions I ever picked up. It was like this and 12 Angry Men, and I think Something Wild for some reason, which I'm going to try to write about for my site, The Spool, for because we're doing a whole month of Jonathan Demme.
The reason is it's one of Jonathan Demme's best movies, if
it's
not.
It's great and charming best. As fuck. Yeah.
Yeah, I love that one.
Talking about like the weird overlaps, the original director of Peggy Sue Got Married, Jonathan Demme.
Huh. Oh, yeah, yeah.
He's directing Deborah Winger.
I got to say, I think that would have been better. But
I agree, you know, and I love Kathleen Turner's performance, but yeah, I think, you know, Jonathan Demme understands women's psyches in a way that Francis Ford Coppola does.
Yes, it's true. It's true. So maybe that's a good enough segue to move over to a movie that I think is still good, but I definitely have issues with. Peggy Sue Got Married.
Peggy Sue was once crazy about the guy she married.
I have certain unresolved feelings about your father. I don't trust him.
But tonight, at her 25-year high school reunion...
Well, Charlie won't be here tonight. We're getting divorced, actually.
She'll disappear in time. And arrive in her senior year of high school.
What am I doing here?
You passed out for a minute, that's all.
Oh, Mom, what is going on?
You're home now.
What do you think, Peggy Sue?
You bought an Edsel.
Now, she's got the chance to start over again.
I have a headache.
This time, she'll know better.
Should we break up? Because if we did, I don't even know about it.
What if you fall into the hands of some madman with plans to manipulate your brain?
Well, that's why I was getting a divorce.
Dan, why don't you talk us through sort of the story of Peggy Sue Got Married?
Sure. Let's think of it as maybe a reverse Back to the Future. It's not a kid going back to, you know, save his parents' marriage. It's a middle-aged woman going back to when she grew up to kind of try and put right her own life.
What once went wrong?
Yeah.
And hope that each timer next week was the legal. Oh, boy.
No, you know, and it's got Kathleen Turner as the titular Peggy Sue, and Nicolas Cage is her high school boyfriend who she married, who wanted to be a musician but ended up being a local, I guess, electronic salesman who slept around on her. Yeah, and as the movie begins, they are getting a divorce. She goes back to her school for a reunion, passes out when she is brought up to be, I guess, queen of the reunion, which is not, as far as I know, a thing that happens at reunions.
No. She fainted at the novelty of it. She's like, yeah. I've never heard of this.
Well, it also seemed very weird that they're like, you've had a sad life and you got divorced, so you're a queen!
Yeah.
Compared to the rest of us, you're doing great, hon.
Yeah. I know I'm in the middle of the synopsis, but I want to say, so for the Flophouse, the podcast I do about bad movies, we just talked about Little Italy, which is a comedy, a romantic comedy where Hayden Christensen and Emma Roberts are purported to be the same age, even though Hayden Christensen is a decade older than Emma Roberts. And this film,
the poster just flashed in front of my eyes. Yeah.
In this film, Kathleen Turner is a 32-year-old playing a 42-year-old, and meanwhile, her husband, Nicolas Cage, is a good 9 years younger than Kathleen Turner. And Kathleen Turner plays 42 fairly well in these early scenes by sort of, you know, changing, like, they change her hairstyle. She just acts older, you know, like, it's pure performance. And Nicolas Cage is, like, swanning around in these early, like, scenes, and they've, like, stuck, like, you know, like high school production gray in his hair and sort of like have him like in these polyester suits with his like the shirt open. That's the most ridiculous attempt to make him look older.
Well, this is how fucking ridiculous this is. And it's very, very distracting. But Nicolas Cage, who was 24 years old when he played a 43-year-old man, is the exact same age as Helen Hunt, who plays their daughter. So Nicolas Cage is literally the same age as the woman who plays his daughter. And again, I love Nicolas Cage, but holy fuck, you seem like a 24-year-old playing a 42-year-old. They pointed out, like, with Back to the Future, they got a bunch of 20-somethings and then aged them the fuck out to play 40-something. That worked a whole lot better than other casting people between the ages of 23 and 35 to play teenagers. Because, yeah, it's Jim Carrey.
Who actually steals scenes out from under Nick Cage, I think is very interesting.
Well, I think there's also probably a draft of this movie that has 47 minutes of Jim Carrey improvising wildly. That they had to cut. And it's, who would have thought that Francis Ford Coppola casting Jim Carrey and Nicolas Cage, they both would give extra, extra, extra performances.
Oh, yeah. But Dan, you were saying about the plot.
Oh, you know, she goes back to when she was in high school. She does a lot of things differently. You know, like, it's one of these, if I knew then what I know now, situations. And she sleeps with the artsy guy rather than sticking with Nicolas Cage. Although,
with Benny from The Mummy.
Yeah. Although there's still, like, this, you know, an...
yeah.
There's this inherent sweetness to adenoidal Nick Cage that she can't deny. And, you know, like, history basically repeats itself, and she wakes up back in her old life. And it's kind of, like, not entirely clear whether she's actually affected anything. Like, there's indications that, you know, this may have been more than just a dream. Like, the guy that she slept with, like, sent her, like, a book or dedicated a book or whatever. And, like, and Nicolas Cage now in the future seems to have grown up a lot more as a result of maybe some of the, like, scents that Kathleen Turner knocked into him in the past. And, you know, they seem to be en route to mending things.
Well, I think the biggest indicator that things will have changed is 5 minutes later, whether she finds out whether or not she's a millionaire. Because one of the things she does is, like, hey, she goes up to the brainy nerd in high school who has, you know, his eyes in the sky. And it is like, yeah, and is basically telling him, like, okay, so pantyhose, remember, invent pantyhose. And also everything gets smaller except for stereos. They get bigger, portable radios. They get bigger for some reason, which feels like a weirdly racially charged reference to boomboxes. But it's so... That's sort of the major thing. I just want to see, like, a 5 minutes later Peggy Sue Got Married thing where she checks her, like, stock portfolio.
I just want to say that this is maybe the first time that the movie going audience said, what the fuck is Nicolas Cage doing? And why didn't somebody stop him from doing it? I remember seeing, I saw this in the theaters when I was 10 years old, and I remember being moved by it. I think I was precocious enough that I'm like, the themes of regret and longing and feeling bad about mortality, they're really resonating with me. But then, like, who is this guy doing this, like, bizarre cartoon?
I gotta say, I don't know.
Why is it so jarring and so out of why is it totally so different from the rest of the film?
Oh, Nathan, I could not disagree more.
Like, in a good and a bad way. But it's a, like, huge performance in a movie that is generally a lot subtler and a lot gentler than either him or Jim Carrey tend to be.
To me, Nicolas Cage's performance is the jolt of energy that this movie needs, because, like, this is a very, very sweet movie, you know, like, I love Kathleen Turner. She was, like, I wish she, you know, like, her career had sort of, like, continued to span so that she was getting, you know, great roles still now. Like, I think she's marvelous, and she's marvelous here and so warm, and she's doing subtle work, but, like, the movie itself kind of just, like, dithers around and meander, like, once she gets back into the past, like, there's not really much of a sort of plot driver at all. She just kind of hangs out. And Nicolas Cage has, like, he's doing the silly thing, but I find it very touching. Like, he, of all of them, like, to me, feels like an awkward teen.
Because he was an awkward teen 5 years earlier.
Could be.
It feels like he's pulling a prank on the movie, and because his, like, his uncle's the director, no one can say anything.
It seems like it's a trick voice. It's like, are you really going to do that for the whole fucking thing?
I did read that Francis Ford Coppola almost fired him, even though it was his nephew. And Nicolas Cage was like, you know, no, trust me, and like convinced him.
Yeah, it's just one of those things where, you know, I totally get, because we all know Nick Cage for making these big choices, but at least for us to a certain extent, like, the movies expect him to make those big choices and build themselves around him. At least the good ones do. This feels like his big choices are intruding into this movie that really wants to be its own thing. And whether that works for you in Dan's case or it doesn't work for you, as in your case, Nathan, I think I lean towards your sort of instinct in that case.
I do want to say that with Nathan's like precocious sort of wistfulness. So I remember seeing this movie when I was much too young a kid to sort of understand it. But my reaction to it was, oh, that was, you know, like a pleasant movie. It was funny. Like, there was a sweetness to it that I liked. But in the end, I'm like, eh, it's okay. And in anticipation for doing this show, I was like, oh, this will be nice to revisit Peggy Sue Got Married, because now I am a middle-aged person. A middle-aged person who went through a divorce, a middle-aged person who has regrets, who, like, is hopefully wiser as well as older, and maybe I will find it touching in a way that I didn't before to see this movie. Maybe it will connect with me. And I watched it again, and largely I had the same reaction I did when I was a kid, where I'm like, oh, that was pleasant. There was some funny stuff in it. I liked it okay. Like, the stuff I liked most about it was how Kathleen's turn, how Peggy Sue dealt with kind of the social politics of high school, how she cut through the shit where she's like, none of this is important, so I'm not going to treat it like it is. You know, you're going to be a dick to me. I'm going to be a bigger dick to you. I'm not going to care about these classes. I'm not going to care about whether I'm hanging out with a nerd or not. Like, that stuff was fun to me. I mean, that's like the most kind of obviously crowd-pleasing stuff, but it still is the stuff that I connected with.
Yeah, and I mean, I think the things that resonated most for me, because there were times when I did get a little choked up. This was actually my first time seeing this, by the way. Which was, and Bobby's as well. She is near the microphone, my cat. For me, what really got me were those first few scenes where she is back in the past and she sees her mother again for the first time and her baby sister, and she hears from her grandmother and she's moved to tears because these are people that she has lost, and suddenly she gets a second chance with them. And I found that really kind of poignant, like, even independent of the high school stuff, you know, like that's,
I found that really, really poignant as well. And it also made me think a lot about Back to the Future, which came out an early year before this, which is very much kind of like a complimentary film. And the fact that Robert Zemeckis managed to do this kind of story and have zero sentimentality whatsoever. Yeah. If anything, you have like reverse anti-sentimentality, where it's like, boy, I need to like figure out how not to fuck my hot mom. Grandmother, you're still alive. I'm going to weep uncontrollably while we just like sit in each other's. And there's also an element of, you know, when she's back in 1960. And I was thinking, like, okay, if you were 18 in 1960, in 1967, you'd be 25, so you theoretically would be a place to, like, do the sexual revolution, to, like, experience the counterculture, do all of these things, and there's a sense in the movie that just, like, she has this life, and again, there are so many different, I mean, the fact that she's so overwhelmed is very, very touching to me, that she's just like, I can't believe that I have this opportunity again, like, all these people are dead, and I love them, and I miss them, and there's this really fascinating thing where, you know, she, like, dallies with Kevin O'Connor, the beatnik, Maynard G, whatever, and again, there's a sense of, it didn't matter who she ended up with, she was gonna be screwed no matter what. And there's this great scene where he's talking about, you know, like, oh, it's going to be great. You know, we're going to live on a farm, you and, like, my other wife, and you'll all support me while I do my writing. And she's like, oh, if I chose this different thing, I would still be screwed. It would just be a different kind of terrible situation. And I feel like in a lot of different versions of this movie, there would be something horrible that she's running from, like a death, a child, you know, getting hit by a car, something horrible. In this movie, what she's running from is that she had a bad marriage and they got divorced. And, like, that sucks and that's difficult, but that's not the death of a child. that's not this huge melodramatic thing. That's something that, like, people understand. And again, I think part of what makes Nicolas Cage's performance so weird and so interesting is you're constantly thinking, should they be together? Should they not be together? He's a fucking drip. She's Kathleen Turner. He's so obnoxious, but he's also kind of sweet. There's just this ambivalence, like, from the entire film where it's not ever, but also just the fact that his performance is a little cartoonish and a little broad and a little crazy. That again kind of clashes with the rest of this movie, which is sentimental, which is a little more nuanced, which is a little more regretful and nuanced and kind of like looking at the past and can we change destiny and, you know, what is it really all about?
I do want to say, to prove that I'm not a heartless monster, Clance, I did respond to these sort of familial, reunions. I think that,
did it give you some stirrings in your robot power pack,
Dan? My robot, yes, I did. Well, you know, like, I particularly like the stuff with her sister. I can't recall whether...
Sofia Coppola?
Yeah, I can't recall whether we get a sense of, like, what happened with her in the present. Did they address that at all?
I don't know if they did, but just through implication for how, you know, glad she was to see her, it was just like... I don't know. It was really, like, really weird,
like,
for me.
Yeah, maybe they're estranged. I don't know. Or, like, maybe it's just, like, the magic of seeing her young again. Like, the thing about that for me was that, you know, Sofia Coppola, obviously a very, very amazing director, but got, like, a lot of shit for her performance in Godfather 3. Here, you know, you can tell she's not necessarily an actor, but it works for the movie.
Not like a lot feels, is asked of her.
She feels like a genuine teen to me.
Yeah.
And the joy that Kathleen Turner has seeing her, like, young sister is very sweet.
Yeah, it is.
I also thought it was interesting, too, that they're kind of the plot of Yesterday is kind of embedded within this movie where, she's like, oh, goodness, it's 1960. I should go to Liverpool and discover the Beatles. Then Nicolas Cage is a singer. And that's another thing that's interesting to me because we've kind of talked about this. And one of the things that makes Nicolas Cage an interesting icon and human being and actor is that he's a rocker. You know, as corny and as goofball as it is, like, he's somebody who, like, has a lot of Elvis in him and loves the doo-wop. There's just seeing him and Jim Carrey singing doo-wop together is just kind of lovely, even if, again, everybody's either way too old or way too young.
Well, I love that they're a quartet, but you can just tell that it's all Nicolas Cage and Jim Carrey, and it's just these other two schmoes that no one cares about.
Mm-hmm. One of them was, like, in Greece, and he was, like, 40 then, so I'm like, dude.
Always 40.
I mentioned this on the Flophouse, but I saw a slightly advanced screening of Color Out of Space where they did a simulcast of a Q&A that Patton Oswalt moderated with Nicolas Cage and Richard Stanley, both of them prime weirdos. And Nicolas Cage was wearing this jacket that was like a rockabilly guy was also a wrestler. And, like, he is super rock and roll, but also, like, him talking to other people in the cast, like, he, like, called everyone up on stage, like, you know, come on, everyone's got, you know, like, and it was just weird, like, to see him sort of, like, shut off when he wasn't the one talking, because, like, he seems like, when you hear him talk about acting, which I haven't before, but, like, I did at this, during this Q&A, he is a very committed, smart guy in a way that goes against this, like, internet meme version of Nicolas Cage, right? Like, everyone thinks that he's just, like, this madman, whatever. But he's, you know, he is dedicated to doing this. Like, he is making choices that are carefully calibrated, whether or not you agree with them, they're big choices. But, like, he is a really smart actor. And then... But to see him, like, trying to relate to other humans in a normal way was very funny, because when he was not, like, the guy talking, he's like, you could see him, like, be like, I don't know what to do. Like, what is this? Who am I? What's happening?
Oh, is it my turn to talk now? Yeah. It's very wild. And I think that's another reason why, because for all the big choices and Peggy Sue Got Married, I just sort of couldn't get, maybe even because of the big choices, I couldn't get behind the idea that there was sort of a redemption in place for Charlie. Like, I just, no matter what, he tries, there's a second where he tries to smother Peggy Sue and then reconsiders. I just want to point that out. No one, like, don't let him ever forget that. And he tries to, like lure her down to the basement. And, yeah, there's, like, a little bit to where it's, like, a desperate lovesick teen. But, man, he does not make a strong case for himself as the love of his of Peggy Sue's life.
No, and that's, I think it's part of the problem. It's, like, why on earth is she attracted? And, like, the dude is fucking insane. And he's got, like, this crazy voice. And he says all these incredibly stupid things. And it's touching. And there's a lot of pathos to it. They're also like, you're Kathleen fucking Turner, man.
Right.
Yeah, but I think that's maybe a problem inherent to the movie more than his performance, in that, like, she is playing an adult, he is playing a teen, and then it's obvious, like, okay, well, this teen is an idiot because teenagers are idiots.
But here's the thing, though. Like, fine, fuck a hot idiot, but he has to be hot, though.
Well, and that's the other thing that's crazy about it, is, like, every film we've seen with Nicolas Cage before this, he's super fucking hot, he's ripped, he's gorgeous. I mean, the line there where he's like, I've got the teeth, I've got the hair, I've got the eyes. And it's like, in other movies you did from this period, you definitely did. You were a gorgeous human being. Here, you're just such a friggin' goofball. And I think part of what makes his performance here weird is that he wasn't really Nicolas Cage at this point. You know, he was Francis Coppola's nephew. He'd done a couple of movies. Some of them were pretty flashy, but he wasn't, you know, the icon that we know today. We're like, oh man, I want to go see this movie to see Nicolas Cage be fucking crazy. So to see this movie that, again, you know, it's a very commercial film. It did well. You know, Francis Coppola was trying to make a commercial movie that would, like, make money, which is fairly rare. And he accomplished that, but I think, you know, if this performance had come a decade later, people would have expected a little more, they would have processed a little more. I think at this point in his career and his life, is like, who is this fucking lunatic and what is he doing?
And I think Kathleen Turner would have known to expect a little bit of that too, because she was blindsided by this stuff and she hated him on set. He, like, stole chihuahuas or something, like, off the street.
He actually sued her because in her memoir, she said that Cage was arrested twice for drunk driving and, I think, for stealing a dog. He'd come across a chihuahua he liked and stuck it in his jacket.
Yeah, it's just wild.
I refuse to believe that about a young Nicolas Cage.
Right. Who would do that? What kind of lunatic?
Also, this struck me as a very cocaine-y movie.
This is probably the opportune time to say that I did take a photo of myself in New Orleans in front of the pyramid tomb that he bought for himself in one of the oldest cemeteries in the city.
Well, I'm going to Los Angeles in about a week and a half, and you better believe that I'm going to be photographed next to the Hollywood stars of Nicolas Cage and John Travolta. Also, Weird Al Yankovic.
So, yeah, is there anything else we really want to say about Peggy Sue? I did find it interesting that this has a similar sort of climax as Being John Malkovich, where you find out that there's a secret society that also knows about the gimmicky setup behind the movie.
The great eccentric actor, character actor, and, you know, a patriarch of the Carradine family. I feel like the supporting caster is really, really great. Everybody does a good job.
Yeah, Catherine Hicks is in this, Joan Allen, you know, Lucinda Jenny, like, all kinds of fun people.
You know, it's not a bad movie, I do think it's mostly a pleasant movie with moments of wisdom, and it is a movie that makes you wonder, like, okay, well, like, who is Francis Ford Coppola as a director?
Yeah.
Because his early career had this sort of, like, you know, like, passion and cohesiveness, and then I don't know whether, like, he just lost his mind in making Apocalypse Now, but then, like, he, like, faded into this weird, like, nostalgic glow for a long time. And
well, like, with Cotton Club, which we talked about a few episodes back, that's definitely true.
Yeah, I just find it, I like it, but I find this movie just sort of meandering in a way that's not... Here's the thing. Like, I don't mind a meandering movie, but, like, I feel like this movie is too plotted to be meandering and too meandering to be plotted.
I can see that. And there's also an element of the whole, they kind of lay heavy on the time travel elements, where when she goes back to 1960, she's like, oh my god, everything is so 1950s. It's so crazy to see you wearing that 1960s jacket. And you could be like, you seem to be talking like you're a time traveler and you know what happened 25 years from now. Is it just like some weird quirk or something, or has something happened? And I also liked, you know, that the sort of stylistically, this was nominated for an Academy Award for Best Actor, Best Actress rather, Best Cinematography, and I think Best Production Design. And I like the production, or like the cinematography, that when she's back in the past, everything has kind of a soft, nostalgic glow to it. It's kind of how you would experience memories, you know, in the past, mm-hmm. and whereas the stuff...
Which also happens to dovetail with the kind of the shiny golden age look of a 50s movie.
Yeah, and the score, I felt like they used that sort of love theme in trailers for years and years and years and years, because it's very effective, and it's very heavy-handed, and it, yeah, kind of brings the melodrama in a very pure, very effective kind of way.
I do want to say, before we kind of wrap it up on this, I want to acknowledge the fact that, as a man, I am perfectly willing to accept that my preference for Blowout over Peggy Sue Got Married may be related to the fact that I'm a guy. and that perhaps, like, it has a lot of value that I'm not... that I'm simply not connecting with as I could.
Yeah, because I think that's one of the things that's kind of interesting about Peggy Sue Got Married, was a lot of her choices in life were determined by her gender and the time in which she lived. And it's like, you're so much smarter than your husband. You have so much more. And again, part of it is that she's 42 years old, and he's 24, you know, and looks like a 24-year-old the whole time. But yeah, there's a sense, you know, this sort of feminist undercurrent of it. Like, it doesn't matter how smart or what you do right or how much prescience you have. Like, society's only going to let you have so much. And you're going to sabotage yourself as well, and you're going to end up with people who... You know, and the other thing, too, as a father, one of the things I don't really talk about, and again, this is in a more heavy-handed movie, that she's a mother, you know? And they maybe don't talk about it because she's the same age as her daughter. but again, like, Jesus, if I changed everything, like, my sons wouldn't be alive, you know, or they would be different, and I couldn't abide by that. And with Catherine Turner as well, like, you know,
it's Harlan 22
Hunt,
hours.
Harlan Hunt wouldn't exist, you know, and whatever the brother who doesn't get a whole lot of play. So yeah, I think that's a part of it as well. It's sort of like your life and your possibilities and opportunities are very much dictated by the time in which you live and your gender. And it doesn't matter if you take it back, like, you're still going to be kind of screwed all the same. Yeah. And there's something very kind of bitter.
Yeah, no, that's good. I wanted to acknowledge that those are themes that I can recognize in the movie, while perhaps not feeling as deeply as others might.
Also, it's interesting that they mentioned that she has her own business, which I think we have a little more agency. They never say what she
does. I do want to close out this segment with a little bit of trivia that I find interesting. This movie did get made into a musical that opened on London's West End on August 20th, 2001. A little thing happened a month or so later.
Yeah,
you may have heard of called 9/11, and apparently after 9/11, like, London, like, tourism plummeted to the point where they had to close.
The musical got Zoolandered.
Yeah, pretty much. Yeah, it closed on Halloween 2001.
Ooh. And that's funny, because actually last week's John Travolta number, a little movie called Urban Cowboy, also was a very unsuccessful Broadway musical and West End musical. Even though you'd think that would seem to make a whole lot more sense, and actually Peggy Sue Got Married makes a certain sense, because there are so many melodramatic elements to it. There's so many songs.
There's the 50s aesthetic, too. You can go kind of a Grease Hairspray direction with it. Where's the Blowout musical, I ask you? That's what I want.
You're a noise. What could it be?
Now that we're sort of at this point, I think it's time to talk about the cage match, where we try to figure out which of these two movies is better, and which will move on to whatever nebulous next round will happen whenever we eventually get through to these movies. I did want to point out, I'm really trying, guys, to, like, do more stuff on the Travolta Cage Twitter, which you can follow at Travolta Cage. And Travolta Cage Pod, sorry. No, it's just Travolta Cage. And I did do a poll for this one, like which movie would people prefer? And people did vote for Blowout. The final results, 62% to 38%. Does that match with your guys's assumptions?
Assumptions? I don't know about that. It matches with my preferences.
Your preferences, I guess. I mean, yeah.
I like Brian De Palma. I realize that there's a certain sleaziness that goes along with him, but it's weirdly charming for me, as I said before, because he's so upfront about it. Maybe others feel differently, but like, this is probably, if not my favorite, top three De Palma movies, along with I suppose I would say Sisters and Phantom of the Paradise. Yeah, I like that this movie quite a bit, and you know, and whereas Peggy Sue Got Married, I don't want to undersell it. It's got a lot of very good qualities, but it's more of like a pleasant Saturday afternoon's watch for me.
I think you always have to, either with Peggy Sue Got Married, you either have to be super on board with Cage and are bored by the rest, or intrigued by the rest of it, and Nick Cage is just so jarring that he takes you out of it. It's kind of like neither the twain shall meet, so to speak. Nathan, what about you?
As I sort of said before, I think Peggy Sue Got Married is a good movie. It's a moving motion picture. There's a lot of pathos. There's a lot of emotion. Blowout is just about perfect. It's one of the best thrillers I've seen, just in terms of pure craft. It's very, very hard to beat. And the beginning and the ending are really, really powerful. And one of Travolta's best performances, and also one of his kind of most serious performances. You know, he doesn't really kind of fall back on his tics and mannerisms. It's acting, which people don't necessarily expect from John Travolta. But yeah, this was a terrific motion picture. I've seen it 3 or 4 times, and I think I like it better each time.
Yeah, I'm inclined to agree. I mean, just again, as a fellow film boy, like the two of you, I'm over the moon about Blowout. I've just been such a big fan of it for so long. And I found myself pleasantly surprised by Peggy Sue Got Married. I don't even know if surprised. I mean, I'd heard it was good, but finally seeing it, I did see quite a lot of charms. But funny enough, it was Nick Cage that like ruined it for me. So especially in this Travolta versus Cage kind of framework we're working with, I have to give it to Blowout. So congrats, Blowout, for moving on to whatever next round will manifest itself half a decade from now when we're finally through the movies, if we're ever at that point.
Although, again, speaking of like these weird sort of patterns, overlapping things, I love that in the 1960 version of the film, Nicolas Cage is introduced pretending to be a vampire. three years later, you know, he'd be freaking Vampire's Kiss, and by that point America was ready for Nicolas Cage to go that big and that crazy and that broad, albeit in a movie that kind of exists for the sake of Nicolas Cage going crazy and broad and going for it in the biggest possible sense.
Exactly. So until we get to that point, I think that wraps it up for this episode of Travolta Cage. Dan, thank you so much for coming on the show.
Thank you.
Why don't you tell people where they can find your stuff?
If you're infected by the virus that is Twitter, which I have become deeply, even though it's cesspool, you can find me at Dan K. McCoy. It's impossible to read that as anything but Dank McCoy. And also go to flophousepodcast.com if you want to hear a podcast that has a little less in the way of sort of serious film analysis and a little more talk about DuckTales.
My Twitter account is Nathan Raven. I have a podcast called Travolta Cage. I have a book called The Weird Accordion to Al that is out. And then on February 22nd, I will be doing a weird and insane afternoon with Nathan Raven at Dynasty Typewriter, which is one of Los Angeles' hippest and most exciting and buzzed about theaters. And yeah, I could not be more excited about it. I'm going to Los Angeles for Juggalo Days, ICP's big concert, and then yeah, I'm going to do it on a podcast. And please come and see me. It's like 3:30 the show, and I'm terrified that nobody will show up. And that will be very terrifying. But it's going to be great. And yeah, I haven't done an event like that in 7 years. So I'm very, very excited about that. So buy my book and then go see me at Dynasty Typewriter at 3:30 on February 22nd.
Excellent. And you can find my stuff on Twitter at Clint Worthing. I also write for my site, The Spool. You can find that at The Spool and Consequence of Sound and all that other fun stuff. Nathan, what are we doing next episode?
Oh, and actually one last thing. I'm Nathan Raven's Happy Place. We just did our... I had my readers and patrons vote on a poll to determine what I will be writing about in the year ahead. So they voted, and I got a lot of weird, interesting stuff coming on, stuff like Phil Hartman Month, Video Game Month, Direct-to-Video Sequels Month, Nora Ephron Month. I certainly didn't vote for that, but that will be interesting. That is very, very exciting. So check out NathanRaven.com for all of the fun and excitement and adventure.
Excellent. And at NathanRaven.com, you can also find the podcast itself, Travolta Cage, which you just finished listening to.
Oh, and then to answer your question, tardily, we have maybe one of our best lineups for next week. We have Raising Arizona, which I have not seen in a while. Very, very excited for that. And Staying Alive. So we've got a great movie, and then an incredibly entertaining, terrible movie that I'm excited to revisit all over again.
Excellent. Well, that wraps it up for this episode of Travolta Cage. You can subscribe to us on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Spotify, whatever your podcast platform may be. Follow us on Twitter at Travolta Cage. You can go to our Patreon at patreon.com/TravoltaCage. Do all that fun stuff. Thank you so much for listening, and we'll see you next time. Excuse me, I have to go poo.